Experiments with parasites found on plants indicate that even the lowest order of life is enabled to take advantage of natural law. This experiment was made by Jacques Locke, an MD, PhD, and a member of the Rockefeller Institute. In order to obtain the material, potted rose bushes are brought into a room and placed in front of a closed window. If the plants are allowed to dry out, the aphids, previously wingless, change to winged insects. After the metamorphosis, the animals leave the plants, fly to the window, and then creep upward on the glass. It's evident that these tiny insects found that the plants on which they'd been thriving were dead, and they could therefore secure nothing more to eat and drink from this source. The only method by which they could save themselves from starvation was to grow temporary wings and fly, and that's exactly what they did. Experiments like these indicate the omniscience as well as omnipotence is omnipresent, and that the tiniest living thing can take advantage of it in an emergency. Part 15 will tell you more about the law under which we live. It's going to explain that these laws operate to our advantage, that all conditions and experiences that come to us are for our benefit, that we gain strength in proportion to the effort expended, and that our happiness is best attained through a conscious cooperation with natural law. Part 15. The laws under which we live are designed solely for our advantage. These laws are immutable. We cannot escape from their operation. All the great eternal forces act in solemn silence, but it is in our power to place ourselves in harmony with them and thus express a life of comparative peace and happiness. Difficulties, inharmonies, and obstacles indicate that we are either refusing to give out what we no longer need, or we are refusing to accept what we require. Growth is attained through an exchange of the old for the new, of the good for the better. It is a conditional or reciprocal action. For each of us is a complete thought entity, and this completeness makes it possible for us to receive only as we give. We cannot obtain what we lack. If we tenaciously cling to what we have, we are able to consciously control our conditions as we come into sense the purpose of what we attract, and are able to extract from each experience only what we require for our further growth. Our ability to do this determines the degree of harmony or happiness that we attain. The ability to appropriate what we require for our growth continually increases as we reach higher planes and broader visions. And the greater our abilities to know what we require, the more certain we shall be to discern its presence, to attract it, and to absorb it. Nothing may reach us except what is necessary for our growth. All conditions and experiences that come to us do so for our benefit. Difficulties and obstacles will continue to come until we absorb their wisdom and gather from them the essentials of further growth. That we reap what we sow is mathematically exact. We gain permanent strength, exactly to the extent of the effort required to overcome difficulties. The inexorable requirements of growth demand that we exert the greatest degree of attraction for what is perfectly in accord with us. Our highest happiness will be best attained through our understanding of and conscious cooperation with natural laws. In order to possess vitality, thought must be impregnated with love. Love is a product of all the emotions. It is therefore essential that the emotions be controlled and guided by the intellect and reason. It's love which imparts vitality to thought and thus enables it to germinate. The law of attraction or the law of love, for they are one and the same, will bring to it the necessary material for its growth and maturity. The first form which thought will find is language or words. This determines the importance of words. They are the first manifestation of thought, the vessels in which thought is carried. They take hold of the ether and by setting it in motion reproduce the thought to others in the form of sound. Now thought may lead to action of any kind, but whatever the action, it is simply the thought attempting to express itself in visible form. It is evident, therefore, that if we wish desirable conditions, we can afford to entertain only desirable thoughts. This leads to the inevitable conclusion that if we wish to express abundance in our lives, we can afford to think abundance only, and as words are only thoughts taking form, we must be especially careful to use nothing but constructive and harmonious language, which, when finally crystallized into objective forms, will prove to be to our advantage. We can't escape from the picture we incessantly photograph on the mind, and this photography of erroneous conceptions is exactly what is being done by the use of words, when we use any form of language which is not identified with our welfare. We manifest more and more life as our thought becomes clarified and takes higher planes. This is obtained with greater facility as we use word pictures that are clearly defined and relieved of the conceptions attached to them on lower planes of thought. It is with words that we must express our thoughts, and if we are to make use of higher forms of truth, we may use only such material as has been carefully and intelligently selected with this purpose in view. This wonderful power of clothing thoughts in the form of words is what differentiates man from the rest of the animal kingdom. By the use of the written word, he has been enabled to look back over the centuries and see the stirring scenes by which he has come into his present inheritance. He has been enabled to come into communion with the greatest writers and thinkers of all time, and the combined record which we possess today is therefore the expression of universal thought as it has been seeking to take form in the mind of man. We know that the universal thought has for its goal the creation of form, and we know that the individual thought is likewise forever attempting to express itself in form, and we know that the world is a thought form, and a sentence is a combination of thought forms. Therefore, if we wish our ideal to be beautiful or strong, we must see that the words out of which this temple will eventually be created are exact, that they are put together carefully, because accuracy in building words and sentences is the highest form of architecture in civilization and is a passport to success. Words are thoughts, and they are therefore an invisible and invincible power which will finally objectify themselves in the form that they were given. Words may become mental places that will live forever, or they may become shacks which the first breeze will carry away. They may delight the eye as well as the ear. They may contain all knowledge. In them we find the history of the past as well as the hope of the future. They are living messengers from which every human and superhuman activity is born. The beauty of the word consists in the beauty of the thought. The power of the word consists in the power of the thought. And the power of the thought consists in its vitality. How should we identify a vital thought? What are its distinguishing characteristics? It must have principle. There is a principle of mathematics, but none of error. There is a principle of health, but none of disease. There is a principle of truth, but none of dishonesty. There is a principle of light, but none of darkness. And there is a principle of abundance, but none of poverty. How shall we know that this is true? Because if we apply the principle of mathematics correctly, we shall be certain of our results. Where there is health, there will be no disease. If we know the truth, we cannot be deceived by error. If we let in light, there can be no darkness, and where there is abundance, there can be no poverty. Now, these are self-evident facts, but the all-important truth that a thought containing principle is vital and therefore contains life and consequently takes root and eventually but surely and certainly displaces the negative thoughts, which by their very nature can contain no vitality, is the one which seems to have been overlooked. But this is a fact which will enable you to destroy every manner of discord, lack, and limitation. There can be no question but that he who is wise enough to understand will readily recognize that the creative power of thought places an invincible weapon in his hands and makes him a master of destiny. In the physical world, there is a law of compensation, which is that the appearance of a given amount of energy anywhere means the disappearance of the same amount somewhere else. So we find that we can get only what we give. If we pledge ourselves to a certain action, we must be prepared to assume the responsibility for development of that action. The subconscious cannot reason. It takes us at our word. We have asked for something. We are now to receive it. We have made our bed, and we are now to lie in it. The die has been cast. The threads will carry out the pattern that we've made. For this reason, insight must be exercised so that the thought which we entertain contains no mental, moral, or physical germ which we do not wish objectified in our lives. Insight is a faculty of the mind and whereby we are enabled to examine facts and conditions at long range, a kind of human telescope. It enables us to understand the difficulties as well as the possibilities in any undertaking. Insight enables us to be prepared for the obstacles which we shall meet. We can therefore overcome them before they have any opportunity of causing difficulty. Insight enables us to plan to advantage and turn our thought and attention in the right direction instead of into channels which can yield no possible return. Insight is therefore absolutely essential for the development of any great achievement, but with it we may enter, explore, and possess any mental field. Insight is a product of the world within and is developed in the silence by concentration. For your exercise this week, concentrate on insight. Take your accustomed position and focus the thought on the fact that to have a knowledge of the creative power of thought does not mean to possess the art of thinking. Let the thought dwell on the fact that knowledge does not apply itself, that our actions are not governed by knowledge, but by custom, precedent, and habit. The only way we can get ourselves to apply knowledge is by a determined conscious effort. Call to mind the fact that knowledge unused passes from the mind, that the value of the information is in the application of the principle. Continue this line of thought until you gain sufficient insight to formulate a definite program for applying this principle to your own particular problem. The following is a thought by Horatio Bonar. Think truly, and thy thoughts shall the world's famine feed. Speak truly, and each word of thine shall be a fruitful seed. Live truly, and thy life shall be a great and noble creed. The vibratory activities of the planetary universe are governed by a law of periodicity. Everything that lives has periods of birth, growth, fruitage, and decline. These periods are governed by the septimal law. The law of sevens governs the days of the week, the phases of the moon, the harmonies of sound, light, heat, electricity, magnetism, and atomic structure. It governs the life of individuals and of nations, and it dominates the activities of the commercial world. Life is growth, and growth is change. Each 7 years period takes us into a new cycle. The first 7 years is the period of infancy. The next seven, the period of childhood, representing the beginning of individual responsibility. The next seven represents the period of adolescence. The fourth period marks the attainment of full growth. The fifth period is the constructive period, when men begin to acquire property, possessions, a home, and a family. The next from 35 to 42 is a period of reactions and changes, and this in turn is followed by a period of reconstruction, adjustment, and recuperation, so as to be ready for a new cycle of sevens beginning with the 50th year. There are many who think that the world is just about to pass out of the sixth period, that it will soon enter into the seventh period, the period of readjustment, reconstruction, and harmony, the period which is frequently referred to as the millennium. Those familiar with these cycles will not be disturbed when things seem to go wrong, but can apply the principle outlined in these lessons with the full assurance that a higher law will invariably control all other laws, and that through an understanding and conscious operation of spiritual laws, we can convert every seeming difficulty into a blessing. So here's part 16. Wealth is a product of labor. Capital is an effect, not a cause. A servant, not a master. A means, not an end. The most commonly accepted definition of wealth is that it consists of all useful and agreeable things which possess exchange value. It is this exchange value which is the predominant characteristic of wealth. When we consider the small addition made by wealth to the happiness of the possessor, we find that the true value consists not in its utility, but in its exchange. This exchange value makes it a medium for securing the things of real value whereby our ideals may be realized. Wealth should then never be desired as an end, but simply as a means of accomplishing an end. Success is contingent upon a higher ideal than the mere accumulation of riches, and he who aspires to such success must formulate an ideal for which he is willing to strive. With such an ideal in mind, the ways and means can and will be provided, but the mistake must not be made of substituting the means for the end. There must be a definite fixed purpose, an ideal. Prentice Mulford said, "The man of success is the man possessed of the greatest spiritual understanding, and every great fortune comes of superior and truly spiritual power. Unfortunately, there are those who fail to recognize this power. They forget that Andrew Carnegie's mother had to help support the family when they came to America, that Harriman's father was a poor clergyman with a salary of only $200 a year, that Sir Thomas Lipton started with only 25 cents. These men had no other power to depend upon, but it still did not fail them. The power to create depends entirely upon spiritual power. There are three steps: idealization, visualization, and materialization. Every captain of industry depends upon this power exclusively." In an article in Everybody's Magazine, Henry M. Flagler, the Standard Oil multimillionaire, admitted that the secret of his success was his power to see a thing in its completeness. The following conversation with the reporter shows his power of idealization, concentration, and visualization, all of which are spiritual powers. Did you actually vision to yourself the whole thing? I mean, did you or could you really close your eyes and see the tracks and the trains running and hear the whistles? Did you go as far as that? Yes. How clearly? Very clearly. Here we have a vision of the law. We see cause and effect. We see that thought necessarily precedes and determines action. If we are wise, we shall come into a realization of the tremendous fact that no arbitrary condition can exist for a moment, and that human experience is the result of an orderly and harmonious sequence. The successful businessman is far more often than not an idealist and is every striving for higher and higher standards. The subtle forces of thought as they crystallize in our daily moods is what constitutes life. Thought is the plastic material with which we build images of our growing conception of life. Use determines its existence. As in all other things, our ability to recognize it and use it properly is the necessary condition for attainment. Premature wealth is but the forerunner of humiliation and disaster, because we can't permanently retain anything which we do not merit or which we have not earned. The conditions with which we meet in the world without correspond to the conditions which we find in the world within. This is brought about by the law of attraction. How then shall we determine what it is to enter into the world within? Whatever enters the mind through the senses or the objective mind will impress the mind and result in a mental image which will become a pattern for the creative energies. These experiences are largely the result of environment, chance, past thinking, and other forms of negative thought, and they must be subjected to careful analysis before being entertained. On the other hand, we can form our own mental images through our own interior processes of thought, regardless of the thoughts of others, regardless of exterior conditions, regardless of environment of every kind, and it is by the exercise of this power that we can control our own destiny, body, mind, and soul. It is by the exercise of this power that we take our fate out of the hands of chance and consciously make for ourselves the experiences which we desire. Because when we consciously realize a condition, that condition will eventually manifest in our lives. It is therefore evident that in the last analysis, thinking is the one great cause in life. Therefore, to control thought is to control circumstances, conditions, environment, and destiny. How then are we to control thought? What's the process? To think is to create a thought, but the result of the thought will depend upon its form, its quality, and its vitality. The form will depend upon the mental images from which it emanates. This will depend upon the depth of the impression, the predominance of the idea, and the clarity of the vision, plus the boldness of the image. The quality depends upon its substance, and this depends upon the material of which the mind is composed. If this material has been woven from thoughts of vigor, strength, courage, and determination, the thought will possess these qualities. And finally, the vitality depends upon the feeling with which the thought is impregnated. If the thought is constructive, it will possess vitality. It will have life. It will grow, develop, expand. It will be creative. It will attract to itself everything necessary for its complete development. If the thought is destructive, it will have within itself the germ of its own dissolution. It will die. But in the process of dying, it will bring sickness, disease, and every other form of discord. This we call evil, and when we bring it upon ourselves, some of us are disposed to attribute our differences to a supreme being. But this supreme being is simply mind in equilibrium. It is neither good nor bad. It simply is. Our ability to differentiate it into form is our ability to manifest good or evil. Good and evil, therefore, are not entities. They are simply words which we use to indicate the result of our actions. And these actions are in turn predetermined by the character of our thought. If our thought is constructive and harmonious, we manifest good. If it is destructive and discordant, well, then we manifest evil. If you desire to visualize a different environment, the process is simply to hold the ideal in mind until your vision has been made real. Give no thought to persons, places, or things. These have no places in the absolute. The environment you desire will contain everything necessary. The right persons and the right things will come at the right time and in the right place. It is sometimes not plain how character, ability, attainment, achievement, environment, and destiny can be controlled through the power of visualization, but this is an exact scientific fact. You will readily see that what we think determines the quality of mind, and that the quality of mind in turn determines our ability and mental capacity, and you can readily understand that the improvement in our ability will naturally be followed by increase in attainment and a greater control of circumstances. It will thus be seen that natural laws work in a perfectly natural and harmonious manner. Everything seems to just happen. If you want any evidence of this fact, simply compare results of your efforts in your own life when your actions were prompted by high ideals and when you had a selfish or ulterior motive in mind. You'll need no further evidence. If you wish to bring about the realization of any desire, form a mental picture of success in your mind by consciously visualizing your desire. In this way, you'll be compelling success. You will be externalizing it in your life by scientific methods. We can only see what already exists in the objective world, but what we visualize already exists in the spiritual world. And this visualization is a substantial token of what will one day appear in the objective world if we are but faithful to our ideal. The reason for this is not difficult. Visualization is a form of imagination. This process of thinking forms impressions on the mind, and these impressions in turn form concepts and ideals, and they in turn are the plans from which the master architect will weave the future. The psychologists have come to the conclusion that there is but one sense, the sense of feeling, and that all other senses are but modifications of this one sense. This being true, we know why feeling is the very fountainhead of power, why the emotions so easily overcome the intellect, and why we must put feeling into our thought if we wish results. Thought and feeling is the irresistible combination. Visualization must, of course, be directed by the will. We are to visualize exactly what we want. We must be careful not to let the imagination run wild. Imagination is a good servant but a poor master, and unless it is controlled, it may easily lead us into all kinds of speculations and conclusions which have no basis or foundation of fact whatever. Every kind of plausible opinion is liable to be accepted without any analytical examination, and the inevitable result is mental chaos. We must therefore construct only such mental images as are known to be scientifically true. Subject every idea to a searching analysis and accept nothing which is not scientifically exact. When you do this, you will attempt nothing but what you know. You can carry that out, and success will crown your efforts. This is what businessmen call farsightedness. It is much the same as insight, and is one of the great secrets of success in all important undertakings. For your exercise this week, try to bring yourself to a realization of the important fact that harmony and happiness are states of consciousness, and don't depend upon the possession of things. That things are effects and come as a consequence of correct mental states, so that if we desire material possession of any kind, our chief concern should be to acquire the mental attitude which will bring about the result desired. This mental attitude is brought about by a realization of our spiritual nature and our unity with the universal mind, which is the substance of all things. This realization will bring about everything which is necessary for our complete enjoyment. This is scientific or correct thinking. When we succeed in bringing about this mental attitude, it is comparatively easy to realize our desire as an already accomplished fact. When we can do this, we shall have found the truth which makes us free from every lack or limitation of any kind. H.W. Beecher said, "A man might frame and let loose a star to roll in its orbit, and yet not have done so memorable a thing before God as he who lets a golden orb thought to roll through the generations
of time."
The deity
which a man consciously or unconsciously worships indicates the intellectual status of the worshiper. Ask the Indian of God, and he will describe to you a powerful chieftain of a glorious tribe. Ask the pagan of God, and he'll tell you of a god of fire, a god of water, a god of this, that, and the other. Ask the Israelite of God, and he will tell you of the God of Moses, who conceived it expedient to rule by coercive measures, hence the Ten Commandments, or of Joshua, who led the Israelites into battle, confiscated property, murdered the prisoners, and laid waste to cities. The so-called heathen made graven images of their gods, whom they were accustomed to worship. But among the most intelligent, at least, these images were but the visible fulcrums with which they were enabled to mentally concentrate on the qualities which they desired to externalize in their lives. We of the 21st century worship a God of love in theory, but in practice, we make for ourselves graven images of wealth, power, fashion, custom, and conventionality. We fall down before them and worship them. We concentrate on them, and they are thereby externalized in our lives. The student who masters the contents of Part 17 will not mistake the symbols for the reality. He will be interested in causes rather than effects. He will concentrate on the realities of life and will then not be disappointed in the results. We are told that man has dominion over all things. This dominion is established through mind. Thought is the activity which controls every principle beneath it. The highest principle, by reason of its superior essence and qualities, necessarily determines the circumstances, aspects, and relation of everything with which it comes in contact. The vibrations of mental forces are the finest and consequently the most powerful in existence. To those who perceive the nature and transcendency of mental force, all physical power sinks into insignificance. We're accustomed to look upon the universe with a lens of five senses, and from these experiences our anthropomorphic conceptions originate. But true conceptions are only secured by spiritual insight. This insight requires a quickening of the vibrations of the mind, and is only secured when the mind is continuously concentrated in a given direction. Continuous concentration means an even, unbroken flow of thought, and is the result of patient, persistent, persevering, and well-regulated systems. Great discoveries are the result of long-continued investigation. The science of mathematics requires years of concentrated effort to master it, and the greatest science, that of the mind, is revealed only through concentrated effort. Concentration is much misunderstood. There seems to be an idea of effort or activity associated with it, when just the contrary is necessary. The greatness of an actor lies in the fact that he forgets himself in the portrayal of his character, becoming so identified with it that the audience is swayed by the realism of the performance. This will give you a good idea of true concentration. You should be so interested in your thought, so engrossed in your subject, as to be conscious of nothing else. Such concentration leads to intuitive perception and immediate insight into the nature of all knowledge is the result of concentration of this kind. It is thus that the secrets of heaven and earth have been wrested. It is thus that the mind becomes a magnet, and the desire to know draws the knowledge, irresistibly attracts it, and makes it your own. Desire is largely subconscious. Conscious desire rarely realizes its object when the latter is out of immediate reach. Subconscious desire arouses the latent faculties of the mind, and difficult problems seem to solve themselves. The subconscious mind may be aroused and brought into action in any direction, and made to serve us for any purpose by concentration. The practice of concentration requires the control of the physical, mental, and physical being. All modes of consciousness, whether physical, mental, or physical, must be under control. Spiritual truth is therefore the controlling factor. It is this which will enable you to grow out of limited attainment and reach a point where you'll be able to translate modes of thought into character and consciousness. Concentration does not mean mere thinking of thoughts, but the transmutation of these thoughts into practical values. The average person has no conception of the meaning of concentration. There is always the cry to have, but never the cry to be. They fail to understand that they cannot have one without the other, that they must first find the kingdom before they can have the things added. Momentary enthusiasm is of no value. It is only with unbounded self-confidence that the goal is reached. The mind may place the ideal a little too high and fall short of the mark. It may attempt to soar on untrained wings and instead of flying, fall to earth. But that is not a reason for making another attempt. Weakness is the only barrier to mental attainment. Attribute your weakness to physical limitations or mental uncertainties and try again. Ease and perfection are gained by repetition. The astronomer centers his mind on the stars and they give forth their secrets. The geologist centers his mind on the construction of the earth and we have geology. So with all things. Men center their minds on the problems of life and the result is apparent in the vast and complex social order of the day. All mental discovery and attainment are the result of desire plus concentration. Desire is the strongest mode of action. The more persistent the desire, the more authoritative the revelation. Desire added to concentration will wrench any secret from nature. In realizing great thoughts, in experiencing great emotions that correspond with great thoughts, the mind is in a state where it appreciates the value of higher things. The intensity of one moment's earnest concentration and the intense longing to become and to attain may take you further than years of slow, normal, and forced effort. It will unfasten the prison bars of unbelief, weakness, impotence, and self-belittlement, and you will come into a realization of the joy of overcoming. The spirit of initiative and originality is developed through persistence and continuity of mental effort. Business teaches the value of concentration and encourages decision of character. It develops practical insight and quickness of conclusion. The mental element in every commercial pursuit is dominant as the controlling factor, and desire is the predominating force. All commercial relations are the externalization of desire. Many of the sturdy and substantial virtues are developed in commercial employment. The mind is steadied and directed. It becomes efficient. The principal necessity is the strengthening of the mind so that it rises superior to the distractions and wayward impulses of instinctive life and thus successfully overcomes in the conflict between the higher and lower self. All of us are dynamos, but the dynamo of itself is nothing. The mind must work the dynamo. Then it is useful and its energy can be definitely concentrated. The mind is an engine whose power is undreamed. Thought is an omni-working power. It's the ruler and creator of all form and all events occurring in form. Physical energy is nothing in comparison with the omnipotence of thought because thought enables man to harness all other natural power. Vibration is the action of thought. It is vibration which reaches out and attracts the material necessary to construct and build. There is nothing mysterious concerning the power of thought. Concentration simply implies that consciousness can be focalized to the point where it becomes identified with the object of its attention. As food absorbed is the essence of the body, so the mind absorbs the object of its attention, gives it life, and being. If you concentrate on some matter of importance, the intuitive power will be set in operation, and help will come in the nature of information, which will lead to success. Intuition arrives at conclusions without the aid of experience or memory. Intuition often solves problems that are beyond the grasp of the reasoning power. Intuition often comes with a suddenness that is startling. It reveals the truth for which we are searching so directly that it seems to come from a higher power. Intuition can be cultivated and developed. In order to do this, it must be recognized and appreciated. If the intuitive visitor is given a royal welcome when he comes, he'll come back again. The more cordial the welcome, the more frequent his visits will become. But if he is ignored or neglected, he will make his visits few and far apart. Intuition usually comes in the silence. Great minds seek solitude frequently. It is here that all the larger problems of life are worked out. For this reason, every businessman who can afford it has a private office, where he won't be disturbed. If you cannot afford a private office, you can at least find somewhere where you can be alone a few minutes each day. To train the thought along lines which will enable you to develop that invincible power which is necessary to achieve. Remember that fundamentally the subconscious is omnipotent. There is no limit to the things that can be done when it is given the power to act. Your degree of success is determined by the nature of your desire. If the nature of your desire is in harmony with natural law or the universal mind, it will gradually emancipate the mind and give you invincible courage. Every obstacle conquered, every victory gained will give you more faith in your power, and you'll have greater ability to win. Your strength is determined by your mental attitude. If this attitude is one of success and is permanently held with an unswerving purpose, you will attract to you from the invisible domain the things that you silently demand. By keeping the thought in mind, it will gradually take tangible form. A definite purpose sets causes in motion, which go out in the invisible world and find the material necessary to serve your purpose. You may be pursuing the symbols of power instead of power itself. You may be pursuing fame instead of honor, riches instead of wealth, position instead of servitude. In either event, you will find that they turn to ashes just as you overtake them. Premature wealth or position cannot be retained because it has not been earned. We get only what we give, and those who try to get without giving always find that the law of compensation is relentlessly bringing about an exact equilibrium. The race has usually been for money and other mere symbols of power, but with an understanding of the true source of power, we can afford to ignore the symbols. The man with a large bank account finds it unnecessary to load his pockets down with gold, so with the man who has found the true source of power, he is no longer interested in its shams or its pretensions. Thought ordinarily leads outwardly in evolutionary directions, but it can be turned within where it will take hold of the basic principles of things, the heart of things, the spirit of things. When you get to the heart of things, it is comparatively easy to understand and command them. Now, this is because the spirit of a thing is the thing itself, the vital part of it, the real substance. The form is simply the outward manifestation of the spiritual activity within. For your exercise this week, concentrate as nearly as possible in accordance with the method outlined in this lesson. Let there be no conscious effort or activity associated with your purpose. Relax completely. Avoid any thought of anxiety as to results. Remember that power comes through repose. Let the thought dwell upon your object until it is completely identified with it, until you are conscious of nothing else. If you wish to eliminate fear, concentrate on courage. If you wish to eliminate disease, concentrate on health. If you wish to eliminate lack, concentrate on abundance. Always concentrate on the ideal as an already existing fact. This is the germ cell, the life principle which goes forth and sets in motion those causes which guide, direct, and bring about the necessary relation which eventually manifests itself in form. It's like Emerson said, thought is the property of those only who can entertain it.
In order to grow, we must obtain what is necessary for our growth. This is brought about through the law of attraction. This principle is the sole means by which the individual is differentiated from the universal. Think for a moment, what would a man be if he were not a husband, father, or brother? If he were not interested in the social, economical, political, or religious world? He would be nothing but an abstract, theoretical ego. He exists, therefore, only in his relation to the whole, in his relation to other men, in his relation to society. This relation constitutes his environment, and in no other way. It is evident, therefore, that the individual is simply the differentiation of the one universal mind, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. And his so-called individuality or personality consists of nothing but the manner in which he relates with the whole. This we call his environment, and is brought about by the law of attraction. Part 18, which follows, has something more to say concerning this important law. There is a change in the thought of the world. This change is silently transpiring in our midst, and is more important than any which the world has undergone since the downfall of paganism. These present revolutions in the opinions of all classes of men, the highest and most cultured of men, as well as those of the laboring class, stands unparalleled in the history of the world. Science has of late made such vast discoveries, has revealed such an infinity of resources, has unveiled such enormous possibilities and such unsuspected forces, that scientific men more and more hesitate to affirm certain theories as established and beyond doubt, or to deny other theories as absurd or impossible. A new civilization is being born. Customs, creeds, and precedent are passing. Vision, faith, and service are taking their place. The fetters of tradition are being melted off from humanity, and as the impurities of materialism are being consumed, thought is being liberated, and truth is rising full, robed before an astonished multitude. The whole world is on the eve of a new consciousness, a new power, and a new realization within the self. Physical science has resolved matter into molecules, molecules into atoms, and atoms into energy, and it has remained for Mr. J. A. Fleming, in an address before the Royal Institution, to resolve this energy into mind. He says, "In its ultimate essence, energy, man may be incomprehensible by us except as an exhibition of the direct operation of that which we call mind or will. And this mind is the indwelling and ultimate. It is immanent in matter as in spirit. It is the sustaining, energizing, all-pervading spirit of the universe. Every living thing must be sustained by this omnipotent intelligence, and we find the difference in individual lives to be largely measured by the degree of this intelligence which they manifest. It is greater intelligence that places the animal in a higher scale of being than the plant, the man higher than the animal, and we find that this increased intelligence is again indicated by the power of the individual to control modes of action and thus to consciously adjust himself to his environment. It is this adjustment that occupies the attention of the greatest minds, and this adjustment consists in nothing else than the recognition of an existing order in the universal mind, for it is well known that this mind will obey us precisely in proportion as we first obey it. It is the recognition of natural laws that has enabled us to annihilate time and space, to soar in the air and to make iron float, and the greater the degree of intelligence, the greater will be our recognition of these natural laws, and the greater will be the power that we can possess. It is the recognition of the self as an individualization of this universal intelligence that enables the individual to control those forms of intelligence which have not yet reached this level of self-recognition. They do not know that this universal intelligence permeates all things ready to be called into action. They do not know that it is a responsive to every demand, and they are therefore in bondage to the law of their own being. Thought is creative, and the principle on which the law is based is sound and legitimate, and is inherent in the nature of things. But this creative power does not originate in the individual, but in the universal, which is the source and foundation of all energy and substance. The individual is simply the channel for the distribution of this energy. The individual is simply the means by which the universal produces the various combinations which result in the formation of phenomena, which depends upon the law of vibration, whereby various rates of rapidity of motion in the primary substance form new substances only in certain exact numerical ratios. Thought is the invisible link by which the individual comes into communication with the universal, the finite with the infinite, the seen with the unseen. Thought is the magic by which the human is transformed into a being who thinks and knows and feels and acts. As the proper apparatus has enabled the eye to discover worlds without number millions of miles away, so with the proper understanding, man has been enabled to communicate with the universal mind, which is the source of all power. The understanding which is usually developed is about as valuable as a VCR without a videotape. In fact, it is usually nothing more than a belief, which means nothing at all. The savages of the Cannibal Islands believe something, but that proves nothing. The only belief which is of any value to anyone is a belief that has been put to a test and demonstrated to be a fact. It is then no longer just a belief, but has become a living faith or truth. And this truth has been put to the test by hundreds of thousands of people, and has been found to be the truth exactly in proportion to the usefulness of the apparatus which they used. A man would not expect to locate stars hundreds of millions of miles away without a sufficiently strong telescope, and for this reason science is continually engaged in building larger and more powerful telescopes, and is continually rewarded by additional knowledge of the heavenly bodies. So with the understanding, men are continually making progress in the methods which they use to come into communication with the universal mind and its infinite possibilities. The universal mind manifests itself in the objective through the principle of attraction that each atom has for every other atom in infinite degrees of intensity. It's by this principle of combining and attracting that things are brought together. This principle is of universal application and is the sole means whereby the purpose of existence is carried into effect. The expression of growth is met in a most beautiful manner through the instrumentality of this universal principle. In order to grow, we must obtain what is essential for our growth, but as we are all times a complete thought entity, this completeness makes it possible for us to receive only as we give. Growth is therefore conditioned on reciprocal action, and we find that on the mental plane, like attracts like, that mental vibrations respond only to the extent of their vibratory harmony. It's clear, therefore, that thoughts of abundance will respond only to similar thoughts. The wealth of the individual is seen to be what he inherently is. Affluence within is found to be the secret of attraction for affluence without. The ability to produce is found to be the real source of wealth of the individual. It's for this reason that he who has his heart in his work is certain to meet with unbounded success. He will give and continually give, and the more he gives, the more he's going to receive. Now, what are the great financiers of Wall Street, the captains of industry, the statesmen, the great corporation attorneys, the inventors, the physicians, the authors? What do each of these contribute to the sum of human happiness but the power of their thought? Thought is the energy which the law of attraction is brought into operation, which eventually manifests in abundance. The universal mind is static mind, or substance in equilibrium. It is differentiated into form by our power to think. Thought is the dynamic phase of mind. Power depends upon consciousness of power. Unless we use it, we shall lose it. And unless we are conscious of it, we cannot use it. The use of this power depends upon attention. The degree of attention determines our capacity for the acquirement of knowledge, which is another name for power. Attention has been held to be the distinguishing mark of genius. The cultivation of attention depends upon practice. The incentive of attention is interest. The greater the interest, the greater the attention. The greater the attention, the greater the interest. Action and reaction. Begin by paying attention. Now, before long, you will have aroused interest. This interest will attract more attention, and this attention will produce more interest, and so on and so on. This practice will enable you to cultivate the power of attention. Okay, now this week, concentrate upon your power to create. Seek insight, perception. Try to find a logical basis for the faith which is in you. Let the thought dwell on the fact that the physical man lives and moves and has his being in the sustainer of all organic life, air. We have to have air so that we must breathe. We breathe to live. Then let the thought rest on the fact that the spiritual man also lives and moves and has his being in a similar but subtler energy upon which he must depend for life, and that, as in the physical world, no life assumes form until after a seed is sown, and no higher fruit than that of the parent stock can be produced. So in the spiritual world, no effect can be produced until the seed is sown, and the fruit will depend upon the nature of the seed, so that the results which you secure depend upon your perception of law in the mighty domain of causation, the highest evolution of human consciousness. As Emerson said, "There is no thought in my mind, but it quickly tends to convert itself into a power and organizes a huge instrumentality of
means."
There is
a powerful form of thought. It paralyzes the nerve centers, thus affecting the circulation of the blood. This, in turn, paralyzes the muscular system so that fear affects the entire being, body, brain, and nerve, physical, mental, and muscular systems. Of course, the way to overcome fear is to become conscious of power. What is this mysterious vital force which we call power? We don't really know, but then neither do we know what electricity is. But we do know that by conforming to the requirements of the law by which electricity is governed, it will be our obedient servant, that it will light our homes, our cities, run our machinery, and serve us in many useful capacities. And so it is with vital force. Although we don't know what it is, and possibly may never know, we do know that it is a primary force which manifests through living bodies, and that by complying with the laws and principles by which it is governed, we can open ourselves to a more abundant inflow of this vital energy, and thus express the highest possible degree of mental, moral, and spiritual efficiency. This part tells of a very simple way of developing this vital force. If you put into practice the information outlined in this lesson, you'll soon develop the sense of power which has been the distinguishing mark of genius. And now, Part 19. The search for truth is no longer a haphazard adventure, but it's a systematic process and is logical in its operation. Every kind of experience is given a voice in shaping its decision. In seeking the truth, we're seeking ultimate cause. We know that every human experience is an effect. Then if we may ascertain the cause, and if we shall find that this cause is one which we can consciously control, the effect or the experience will be within our control also. Human experience will then no longer be the football of fate. A man will not be the child of fortune, but destiny. Fate and fortune will be controlled as readily as a captain controls his ship, or as an engineer controls his train. All things are finally resolvable into the same element, and as they are thus translatable one into the other, they must ever be in relation and may never be in opposition to one another. In the physical world there are innumerable contrasts, and these may, for convenience sake, be designated by distinctive names. There are sizes, colors, shades, or ends to all things. There's a north pole and a south pole, an inside and an outside, a seen and an unseen, but these expressions merely serve to place extremes in contrast. They are names given to two different parts of one quantity. The two extremes are relative. They are not separate entities, but are two parts or aspects of the whole.
In the mental world, we find the same law. We speak of knowledge and ignorance, but ignorance is but a lack of knowledge and is therefore found to be simply a word to express the absence of knowledge. It has no principle in itself. In the moral world, we again find the same law. We speak of good and evil, but good is a reality. It's something tangible, while evil is found to be simply a negative condition, the absence of good. Evil is sometimes thought to be a very real condition, but it has no principle, no vitality, no life. We know this because it can always be destroyed by good, just as truth destroys error and light destroys darkness. So evil vanishes when good appears. There is therefore but one principle in the moral world. We find exactly the same law obtaining in the spiritual world. We speak of mind and matter as two separate entities, but clearer insight makes it evident that there is but one operative principle, and that is mind. Mind is the real and the eternal. Matter is forever changing. We know that in the eons of time, 100 years is but as a day. Now, if we stand in any large city and let the eye rest upon the innumerable large and magnificent buildings, the vast array of modern automobiles, cellular telephones, the electric lights, and all of the other conveniences of modern civilization, we may remember that not one of them was there just over a century ago. And if we could stand on the same spot 100 years from now, in all probability we should find that but few of them remained. In the animal kingdom, we find the same law of change. The millions and millions of animals come and go, a few years constituting their span of life. In the plant world, the change is still more rapid. Many plants and nearly all grasses come and go in a single year. When we pass into the inorganic, we expect to find something even more substantial, but as we gaze on the apparently solid continent, we are told that it arose from the ocean. We see the giant mountain. We're told that the place where it now stands was once a lake. And as we stand in awe before the great cliffs in the Yosemite Valley, we can easily trace the path of the glaciers, which carried all before them. We're in the presence of continual change, and we know that this change is but the evolution of the universal mind, the grand process whereby all things are continually being created anew, and we come to know that matter is but a form which mind takes and is therefore simply a condition. Matter has no principle. Mind is the only principle. We have then come to know that mind is the only principle which is operative in the physical, mental, moral, and spiritual world. We also know that this mind is static, mind at rest. We also know that the ability of the individual to think is his ability to act upon the universal mind and convert it into dynamic mind or mind in motion. In order to do this, fuel must be applied in the form of food, for man cannot think without eating. And so we find that even a spiritual activity such as thinking cannot be converted into sources of pleasure and profit except by making use of material means. It requires energy of some kind to collect electricity and convert it into dynamic power. It also requires the rays of the sun to give the necessary energy to sustain plant life. So it also requires energy in the form of food to enable the individual to think and thereby act upon the universal mind. You may know that thought constantly, eternally, is taking form, is forever seeking expression, or you may not. But the fact remains that if your thought is powerful, constructive, and positive, this will be plainly evident in the state of your health, your business, and your environment. If your thought is weak, critical, destructive, and negative, generally it will manifest in your body as fear, worry, and nervousness, in your finances as lack and limitation, and in discordant conditions in your environment. All wealth is the offspring of power. Possessions are of value only as they confer power. Events are significant only as they affect power. All things represent certain forms and degrees of power. A knowledge of cause and effect is shown by the laws governing steam, electricity, chemical affinity, and gravitation enables men to plan courageously and to execute fearlessly. These laws are called natural laws because they govern the physical world. But all power is not physical power. There is also mental power, and there is moral and spiritual power. What are our schools, our universities, but mental powerhouses, places where mental power is being developed? As there are many mighty powerhouses for the application of power to ponderous machinery, whereby raw material is collected and converted into the necessities and comforts of life, so the mental powerhouses collect the raw material and cultivate and develop it into a power which is infinitely superior to all the forces of nature, marvelous though they may be. Now, what is this raw material which is being collected in these thousands of mental powerhouses all over the world and developed into a power which is evidently controlling every other power? In its static form, it is mind. In its dynamic form, it is thought. This power is superior because it exists on a higher plane, because it has enabled man to discover the law by which these wonderful forces of nature could be harnessed and made to do the work of hundreds and thousands of men. It has enabled man to discover laws whereby time and space have been annihilated and the law of gravitation overcome. Thought is the vital force or energy which is being developed and which has produced such startling results in the last half century as to bring about a world which would be absolutely inconceivable to a man existing only 50 or 25 years ago. If such results have been secured by organizing these mental powerhouses in 50 years, what may not be expected in yet another 50 years? The substance from which all things are created is infinite in quantity. We know that light travels at the rate of 186,000 miles per second, and we know that there are stars so remote that it takes light 2,000 years to reach us, and we know that such stars exist in all parts of the heaven. We know, too, that this light comes in waves, so that if the ether on which these waves travel was not continuous, the light would fail to reach us. We can then only come to the conclusion that this substance or ether or raw material is universally present. How then does it manifest in form? In electrical science, a battery is formed by connecting the opposite poles of zinc and copper, which causes a current to flow from one to the other and so provides energy. Now, this same process is repeated in respect to every polarity, and as all form simply depends upon the rate of vibration and consequent relations of atoms to each other, if we wish to change the form of manifestation, we must change the polarity. This is the principle of causation. For your exercise this week, concentrate. And when I use the word concentrate, I mean all that that word implies. Become so absorbed in the object of your thought that you're conscious of nothing else, and do this a few minutes every day. You take the necessary time to eat in order that the body may be nourished. Why not take the time to assimilate your mental food? Let the thought rest on the fact that appearances are deceptive. The earth is not flat, neither is it stationary. The sky is not a dome. The sun does not move. The stars are not small specks of light. And matter, which was once supposed to be fixed, has found to be in a state of perpetual flux. Try to realize the day is fast approaching. Its dawn is now at hand, when modes of thought and action must be adjusted to rapidly increasing knowledge of the operation of eternal principles. The quote from Channing is appropriate. Silent thought is, after all, the mightiest agent.
For many years, there's been an endless discussion as to the origin of evil. Theologians have told us that God is love and that God is omnipresent. If this is true, there is no place where God is not. Where then is evil? Satan and hell? Well, let us see. God is spirit. Spirit is the creative principle of the universe. Man is made in the image and likeness of God. Man is therefore a spiritual being. The only activity which spirit possesses is the power to think. Thinking is therefore a creative process. All form is therefore the result of the thinking process. The destruction of form must also be a result of the thinking process. Fictitious representations of form are the result of the creative power of thought, as in hypnotism. Apparent representations of form are the result of the creative power of thought, as in spiritualism. Invention, organization, and constructive work of all kinds are the result of the creative power of thought, as in concentration. When the creative power of thought is manifested for the benefit of humanity, we call the result good. When the creative power of thought is manifested in a destructive or evil manner, we call the result evil. This indicates the origin of both good and evil. They are simply words which have been coined in order to indicate the nature of the result of the thinking or the creative process. Thought necessarily precedes and predetermines action. Action precedes and predetermines conditions. Part 20 will throw more light upon this important subject. The spirit of a thing is that thing. It is necessarily fixed, changeless, and eternal. The spirit of you is you. Without the spirit, you'd be nothing. It becomes active through your recognition of it and its possibilities. You may have all of the wealth in Christendom, but unless you recognize it and make use of it, you will have no value. So with your spiritual wealth, unless you recognize it and use it, it will have no value.
The one and only condition of spiritual power is use or recognition. All great things come through recognition. The scepter of power is consciousness, and thought is its messenger. And this messenger is constantly molding the realities of the invisible world into the conditions and environments of your objective world. Thinking is the true business of life. Power is the result. You are at times dealing with the magical power of thought and consciousness. What results can you expect so long as you remain oblivious to the power which has been placed within your control? So long as you do, you will limit yourself to superficial conditions and make of yourself a beast of burden for those who think, those who recognize their power, and those who know that unless we're willing to think, we shall have to work, and the less we think, the more we shall have to work, and the less we shall get for our work. The secret of power is a perfect understanding of the principles, forces, methods, and combinations of mind, and a perfect understanding of our relationship to the universal mind. It is well to remember that this principle is unchangeable. If this were not so, it would not be reliable. All principles are changeless. This stability is your opportunity. You are its active attribute, the channel for its activity. The universal can act only through the individual. When you begin to perceive that the essence of the universal is within yourself, is you, you begin to do things. You begin to feel your power. It's the fuel which fires the imagination, which lights the torch of inspiration, which gives vitality to thought, which enables you to connect with all the invisible forces of the universe. It is this power which will enable you to plan fearlessly and to execute masterfully. But perception will come only in the silence. This seems to be the condition required for all great purposes. You are a visualizing entity. Imagination is your workshop. It's here that your ideal is to be visualized. As a perfect understanding of the nature of this power is a primary condition for its manifestation, visualize the entire method over and over and over again so that you may use it whenever occasion requires. The infinity of wisdom is to follow the method whereby we may have the inspiration of the omnipotent universal mind on demand at any time. We can fail to recognize the world within and so exclude it from our consciousness, but it will still be the basic fact of all existence, and when we learn to recognize it, not only in ourselves but in all persons, events, things, and circumstances, we shall have found the kingdom of heaven, which we are told is within us. Our failures are a result of the operation of exactly the same principle. The principle is unchangeable. Its operation is exact. There is no deviation. If we think lack, limitation, discord, we shall find their fruits on every hand. If we think poverty, unhappiness, or disease, the thought messengers will carry this summons as readily as any other kind of thought, and the result is going to be just as certain. If we fear a coming calamity, we shall be able to say with Job, "The thing I feared has come upon me." If we think unkindly or ignorantly, we shall thus attract to ourselves the results of our ignorance. This power of thought, if understood and correctly used, is the greatest labor-saving device ever dreamed of. But if not understood or improperly used, the result will in all probability be disastrous, as we've already seen. By the help of this power, you can confidently undertake things that are seemingly impossible, because this power is the secret of all inspiration, and it's the secret of all genius. To become inspired means to get out of the beaten path, out of the rut, because extraordinary results require extraordinary means. When we come into a recognition of the unity of all things, and that the source of all power is within, we tap the source of inspiration. Inspiration is the art of imbibing, the art of self-realization, the art of adjusting the individual mind to that of the universal mind, the art of attaching the proper mechanism to the source of all power, and it's the art of differentiating the formless into form, the art of becoming a channel for the flow of infinite wisdom, the art of visualizing perfection, the art of realizing the omnipresence of omnipotence. An understanding and appreciation of the fact that the infinite power is omnipresent and is therefore in the infinitely small as well as the infinitely large will enable us to absorb its essence. A further understanding of the fact that this power is spirit and therefore indivisible will enable us to appreciate its presence at all points. An understanding of these facts, first intellectually and then emotionally, will enable us to drink deeply from this ocean of infinite power. An intellectual understanding will be of no assistance. The emotions must be brought into action. Thought without feeling is cold. The required combination is thought and feeling. Inspiration is from within. The silence is necessary. The senses must be stilled, the muscles relaxed. Repose must be cultivated. When you have thus come into possession of a sense of poise and power, you'll be ready to receive the information or inspiration or wisdom which may be necessary for the development of your purpose. Now, don't confuse these methods with those of the clairvoyant. They have nothing in common. Inspiration is the art of receiving and makes for all that is best in life. Your business in life is to understand and command these invisible forces instead of letting them command and rule you. Power implies service. Inspiration implies power. To understand and apply the method of inspiration is to become a Superman. We can live more abundantly every time we breathe if we consciously breathe with that intention. The if is a very important condition in this case. As the intention governs the attention, and without the attention you can secure only the results which everyone else secures, that is, a supply equal to the demand. In order to secure the larger supply, your demand must be increased, and as you consciously increase the demand, the supply will follow. You'll find yourself coming into a larger and larger supply of life, energy, and vitality. The reason for this is not difficult to understand, but it is another of the vital mysteries of life which does not seem to be generally appreciated. If you make it your own, you will find it one of the greatest realities of life. We are told that in Him we live and move and have our being, and we are told that He is a spirit, and again that He is love. So that every time we breathe this life, love, and spirit. This pranic energy, or pranic ether, we could not exist a moment without it. It's the cosmic energy. It is the life of the solar plexus. Every time we breathe, we fill our lungs with air, and at the same time vitalize our body with this pranic ether, which is life itself, so that we have the opportunity of making a conscious connection with all life, all intelligence, and all substance. A knowledge of your relation and oneness with this principle that governs the universe and the simple method whereby you can consciously identify yourself with it gives you a scientific understanding of a law whereby you may free yourself from disease, from lack or limitation of any kind. In fact, it enables you to breathe the breath of life into your own nostrils. This breath of life is a superconscious reality. It is the essence of the I Am. It is pure being or universal substance. And our conscious unity with it enables us to localize it and thus exercise the powers of this creative energy. Thought is creative vibration, and the quality of the conditions created will depend upon the quality of our thought, because we cannot express powers which we do not possess. We must be before we can. And we can do only to the extent to which we are. And so what we do will necessarily coincide with what we are, and what we are depends upon what we think. Every time you think, you start a train of causation which will create a condition in strict accordance with the quality of the thought which originated it. Thought which is in harmony with the universal mind will result in corresponding conditions. Thought which is destructive or discordant will produce corresponding results. You may use thought constructively or destructively, but the immutable law will not allow you to plant a thought of one kind and reap the fruit of another. You are free to use this marvelous creative power as you will, but you must take the consequences. This is the danger from what is called willpower. There are those who seem to think that by force of will they can coerce this law, but they can sow seed of one kind and by willpower make it bear fruit of another. But the fundamental principle of creative power is in the universal, and therefore the idea of forcing a compliance with our wishes by the power of the individual will, is an inverted conception which may appear to succeed for a while, but is eventually doomed to failure because it antagonizes the very power which it is seeking to use. It is the individual attempting to coerce the universal, the finite, in conflict with the infinite. Our permanent well-being will be best conserved by a conscious cooperation with the continuous forward movement of the great whole. Now, for your exercise this week, go into the silence and concentrate on the fact that in Him we live and move and have our being is literally and scientifically exact, that you are because He is, that if He is omnipresent, he must be in you. That if he is all in all, you must be in him. That he is spirit, and you are made in his image and likeness. And that the only difference between his spirit and your spirit is one of degree. That a part must be the same in kind and quality as the whole. When you can realize this clearly, you will have found the secret of the creative power of thought. You will have found the origin of both good and evil. You will have found the secret of the wonderful power of concentration. You will have found the key to the solution of every problem, whether physical, financial, or environmental. The power to think consecutively and deeply and clearly is an avowed and deadly enemy to mistakes and blunders, superstitions, unscientific theories, irrational beliefs, unbridled enthusiasm, and fanaticism. Haddock.